Mrs. Johnson used to say, now that you all have seen what I look like, I'll put my glasses on. Ralph Saul is one of those invaluable people without whom I think the country would collapse in 48 hours, who zigged back and forth between government and private industry several times, and for my own part, I hope he zigs at least once more and we someday see him back in Washington. His career, if the official American Stock Exchange biography is to be believed, actually even started in government. At least the first job that is listed is on the government payroll with the Navy in World War II. He was one of that proud breed, a destroyer man. After the war, he served as a Foreign Service officer in Prague for a couple of years, then went into private law practice in New York. Then entered state government as a special confidential legal assistant to, I don't want to hear any gasps, Governor Thomas E. Dewey. Then went back into private life as a staff attorney for the Radio Corporation of America. Then came to the Securities and Exchange Commission here. That was in 1958, and you will, of course, note that that meant he arrived in Washington also under Republican auspices, but he tells me he's an independent. In any event, I can certainly vouch that those at the Securities and Exchange Commission who worked with him during the 6 years he was there speak very highly of him in every possible way. He began as the head of assistant director of what's now known as their Division of Trading and Markets, the both cops and robbers and fundamental regulatory division, then was detached to become an associate director of the landmark Special Study of Securities Markets. An incredible document, almost 2 years in the making, that laid down perhaps a 20-year program for reform of the securities markets, much of which has been accomplished. Some might say the pace has slackened in recent months for some indiscernible reason. But in any event, much is still going on in terms of implementing the various reforms proposed in that special study, of which he was, I can testify from personal knowledge, one of the very key members. He left the SEC in 1965, having served a couple of years as head of the Division of Trading and Markets, to join Investors Diversified Services, the nation's largest mutual fund complex, and then in 66 to assume his present job as the president of the American Stock Exchange, which I think probably most of you know is, by standard measures, our second largest stock exchange, although there are those who have sometimes likened it to the tail wagging a dog from time to time on some public policy issues. He was born in Brooklyn. The official biography gives it, so I don't suppose there's any reason I shouldn't tell you. He's 47 years old. He does undergraduate work at the University of Chicago. He's, of course, a lawyer. He went to the Yale Law School. I think you will find he is, however, one of that rather rare breed, an English-speaking lawyer. I could tell a number of anecdotes about Ralph Saul, but I think I'll tell the one that just happened to mean the most to me. I went to see him one time when he was head of the Division of Trading and Markets at the SEC. He was always highly accessible and highly straightforward, the two most treasured traits for a reporter. And I asked, I was just starting out on what became an albatross of a long series about mutual funds, and I went in and I asked him a question about Investors Diversified Services. He got up and closed the door to his office. Having done so, he then told me, because he hadn't even told his secretary what he was about to tell me, and swearing me to secrecy, said, Look, I haven't even had time to tell my secretary, and I haven't had the time to tell the chairman of the commission because the decision was made just yesterday. But you asked me a question about Investors Diversified Services, and I think it's only fair before I answer you to tell you I am going to go to work for Investors Diversified Services. That's the kind of prickly integrity Ralph Sewell has. Ralph Sewell.
Thank you very much, Eileen, for that very fine introduction. I would like to make one comment about Eileen. I think you will find, if you're on the receiving end, that she is one of the most perceptive and probing reporters that one can ever face. I think Eileen is one of the best. Esther, there's something you failed to mention about Julia Montgomery Walsh. I just want to everyone to know in the audience that Julia was one of our first woman members of the American Stock Exchange, and for that matter, she was one of the first woman members down on Wall Street. Oh, we were just delighted to have her. This speech, or remarks, or whatever you want to call it, was billed as a nonpartisan series of comments. And just to assure you that it is nonpartisan, I can tell you that I represent a market which you of all have seen is ruthlessly nonpartisan these days. I do appreciate very much, ladies and gentlemen, the opportunity to come here to talk to all of you about some major public issues. In fact, I would like to focus in my remarks on some major questions of national interest that affect and are affected by the securities industry of which I'm a part. Since women are major stockholders in listed companies, since these are questions of national importance, since our goals are democratic capitalism, and since Wall Street is sometimes accused of being a club, it strikes me that the Women's National Democratic Club is a perfect audience. In Washington and elsewhere, there is increasing concern that narrow goals may be taking us in directions we hadn't intended, and that the basic questions affecting the real public interest should be examined and debated. To a small extent, I should like to look at the current trends in the securities industry from this particular vantage point. The patterns of securities regulation of today are the product, as you all know, of the excesses of the 1920s and the 1930s. After the booms, panics, pools, manipulations, and the final crash of the 1920s, the Congress conducted investigations and passed the federal securities laws, which set up the SEC. In fact, it's rather interesting. I had a drink with some of you up in the lounge, and I noticed the lounge was the Sam Rayburn Lounge. As it turns out, Sam Rayburn was the father of the federal securities laws. I think from Washington, we saw a new environment that was created for the securities industry as a result of the laws that were passed in the early 30s. These laws restructured the whole environment in which the smaller and larger investor did his business. The SEC, the exchanges, and the National Association of Securities Dealers, which is also a self-regulatory group, were charged with the administration of the rules and regulations to protect the investor and his markets. Since then, until recently, the system has functioned as planned so well that its growth, I think, has been a great phenomenon of the last several decades. The experience of 29 and the early 30s convinced men and women in government and in the securities business that the overriding public interest required strict prohibitions to restrain strong human drives in the presence of large sums of money. I suppose that the fact that a stock exchange president is standing before you today, a Women's Democratic Club, in Washington, talking about regulation, evidences, it seems to me, some of the startling changes that have occurred in Wall Street towards regulation over the last 30 years. It wasn't too long ago when, this was in the early 30s, when some of the representatives of Wall Street came down to Washington in a spirit of kind of noblesse oblige to talk to the federal government. I don't think that's true any longer. I think the industry now has a very strong stake in regulation. Our view from Washington should be taken with reference to the objectives of the securities laws and their regulations, since they provide the atmosphere in which the public investor now lives with considerable confidence. The objectives of securities regulation, I think, are fairly simple. To ensure that all investors receive material information affecting securities values on an equal basis. That is, that everybody is at the starting gate in terms of getting information at relatively the same time. To maintain public confidence in the marketplace, and to see that professionals do not take unfair advantage of those who are non-professional. And then finally, to make sure that the markets are regulated in the public interest. It seems to me those are the key objectives of the securities laws which we administer. And we do at the exchange as part of the regulatory scheme. A regulation to achieve these public objectives restricts and restrains what may be done by professionals, by underwriters, public brokers, dealers, specialists, floor brokers, investment advisors, stock exchanges, and others performing in the traditional manner. The SEC stands above all of this with overriding responsibility. The exchanges are charged under this scheme with self-regulation in the public interest. And of course, there is the Congress, which conducts frequent reviews of what's happening in the securities industry and, in a sense, performs a fundamental oversight responsibility. The financial community, operating within this environment created by the federal securities laws, has grown and prospered. In fact, it's one of the most remarkable growth industries in the country. In the last 20 years, the number of stockholders has increased from approximately 6 million shareholders to now, we calculate, about 30 million. Trading has increased in all markets. At the Amex, for example, from 66 million shares in a year to 1,200,000,000 shares per year. Thousands of new companies have been financed through these markets. They've grown through public ownership and have been helped by the continuous liquidity, that is, the ability to dispose or buy an investment in these markets. Industrial capitalism has depended on these markets and these laws. Through the 1960s, the velocity of growth has multiplied, and certain fundamental changes have resulted. It may be that the basic alteration in corporate enterprise and in the securities markets during the 1960s has been a change from industrial capitalism to financial capitalism, from concentration on producing goods and services to an increasing concern with earnings per share, price-earnings ratios, and financial results almost independent of the process of production and consumption of industrial products and services. This change affects all of us, stockholders, corporations, securities people, institutions, regulators. In the current issue of Fortune magazine, there is a survey of the demands now being made on corporate executives by the new environment in which they live and by the increasing importance of the stock market in making decisions. The article states, and I quote, it's a long quote, but I think it's very relevant to the point I'm making. In the old days, shareholders were satisfied to look at the scoreboard that reported how the corporation was doing on return on investment, growth of sales, and dividends. Now, however, they score a chief executive's performance mainly on the performance of the stock in the market. A strong drive for improving earnings per share is the new life, and it's a hard one. The chief executive often finds that to get earnings per share increasing fast enough to impress shareholders, he has to grow faster than he can grow by expanding sales in his present markets. So he turns to acquisitions. Multiply this by hundreds and thousands of corporations, and you have the present climate of business, everyone trying to acquire everyone else. And that's not all. The shareholders want their payoffs both now and in the future, and they will not forgive risky gambles that fail. If the chief executive makes a mistake, the shareholders won't wait. They sell. The stock goes down. Invaders loom, or a more successful rival may politely offer a merger or acquisition to improve his earnings per share. At stake is the ultimate value of management, control. And that's the end of the quotation, and I refer to it because I think it does, as I say, exemplify the point that I am trying to make. Because I think the article focuses on the financial pressures which may influence the goals of corporate management. Moreover, the growth of the 60s and its demands have placed pressures on the securities industry. There has been a lot of publicity on this. You've heard about the back office problems and all of the pressures that have been created by unprecedented trading volumes in this new type of market that we're having. Today, we're wrestling with all kinds of issues, such as public ownership of exchange member firms, direct access to public markets by institutions, and the level and structure of commissions. Most of these questions stem from the trend toward management of assets on a pool basis. I think this is the overriding development that has occurred in the securities markets. Smaller investors are buying mutual funds. Larger investors are seeking professional management, sometimes through investment partnerships. Insurance companies are moving into the mutual fund business. Banks offer professional account management. Even some conglomerates act like investment companies as they buy and sell blocks of stock of other companies. Thus, the individual investor who formerly bought and sold round lots or odd lots in the public market increasingly has been delegating his decisions to professional money managers. The development of pooled assets has been helped by aggressive merchandising, expectations of instant performance, inflationary pressures, and healthy compensation incentives to fund sellers and money managers. The magnitude of this trend is obvious. Today, institutions account for about 45% of the share volume on the New York Stock Exchange. On the Amex, we estimate institutional trading at less than half that amount. But in any event, both of these percentages are rising, and they're rising rapidly. In my view, this is the most fundamental change in the securities markets and the one that affects all other considerations. It means, and just I'll exemplify what this means, it means that investment decisions are being concentrated in fewer hands. Instead of 1,000 different decisions to buy or sell 1,000 different securities at 1,000 different times, there is one decision to buy one security at one time. These decisions are made by portfolio managers, many of whom are committed to quick actions, sometimes based on technical market factors and news reports, which increase the chances that large buy or sell orders will hit a stock on the same side of the market simultaneously. In contrast, when a stock is owned by many individuals with differing objectives and opinions, there is less chance the trading decisions will be alike and acted upon quickly. When stockholding is concentrated and trading decisions may be bunched, the public market can be and often is disrupted. There are those who assume that the public market and the specialist who is charged with keeping the market continuous, fair, and orderly are required to absorb or provide stocks in large quantities at all times for the block market, as they do for the public market. However, this question is fundamental. We should ask whether the concepts have changed and whether the old rules are sufficient. The 1960s was a decade of concentration, both through corporate acquisition and merger and institutionalization, which is a big word to say that the institutions are much more active in the securities markets. This concentration in the securities industry has been marked by relationships that may not be new to finance, but are new since adoption of the federal securities laws. It is seen first in the way in which portfolios are managed, two, in the role of the portfolio manager in managing those portfolios, and three, the effect of large institutional stockholders on the stocks, on the companies whose stocks they hold. Most institutional managers follow the guides of fundamental fiduciary responsibility that have always been associated with this profession. For after all, a portfolio manager is, above all, a fiduciary. And many of them are as concerned as we are with some of the recent and rapid changes in their business. While the trends we observe apply only to some portfolio management policies, a minority at this time, competitive pressures it stimulates can affect more responsible managers of public monies. The pressure to continually perform in a short time span has resulted in some money managers acting as traders in the marketplace rather than as fiduciaries. In circumstances where the economic development of a company in which they have invested has not generated gains in the value of a company's securities in the marketplace, the role of some portfolio managers has moved away from that of a passive shareholder. Only a few years ago, articles were published on whether institutions and their portfolio managers should have any influence whatever on management decisions. Recently, this attitude has changed significantly. And there are a number of reasons for that. As institutions become larger owners of corporations, it becomes increasingly difficult for management to deal with portfolio managers as ordinary stockholders. The institutional investor becomes a new constituency distinct from the smaller stockholder. The chief executive officer, concerned about stockholder demands for higher earnings per share, is confronted with a more concentrated problem, one that can be more immediate and perhaps more insistent. In fact, executives of some corporations seeking to improve earnings through acquisitions may have additional reasons to look to institutions as their primary audience, a greater importance in this new game than customers, distributors, employees, or suppliers. Some managements may cooperate with, even seek out institutions in the pursuit of ways to increase earnings per share. When the game focuses on the related goals of higher earnings per share and higher price performance of portfolios, it is only natural that some of these individuals should turn to each other for mutual assistance. Pressures to perform rather than produce may have serious implications for our markets. Many of you who have looked at the markets over the past several years may recall a familiar pattern, a flurry of rumors that Company A was to take over Company B, immediately followed by an increase in the market prices of both companies. Then a tender offered would be announced by Company A for the shares of Company B, with Company A offering a package of securities. If Company B, the target, decided to fight the aggressor corporation, it might organize its defenses, for example, by buying in its own shares, changing the composition of its board, and engaging in other kinds of defensive tactics. This game of warfare has come to be a fascinating part of the financial scene. However, it is interesting to speculate how often institutional portfolio managers who hold large blocks of the companies involved are part of this action, and what kinds of roles they may play, and what their public responsibility should be in this kind of situation. The growth of institutional investing and trading of common stocks has concentrated power where formerly it had been disseminated. Thousands of share owners become one, in effect. The emphasis moves from conservation of capital and returning income on the one hand to market performance on the other. The individual share owner for whose protection the securities laws and the administration of those laws were created is delegating his role to professionals who, in exercising their fiduciary responsibility, become a powerful factor in the market system but are assigned no responsibilities to that system. A competition by some portfolio managers for performance has generated trading patterns in the markets that are marked by high velocity, aggressive buying and selling, and trading in speculative securities. Unlike the institutional investor of a few years ago, and unlike the average investor as reflected on our surveys, turnover of institutional portfolios has increased from roughly 10% in 1960 to 20% in 1969, with mutual fund turnover increasing from about 18 to 50% during the same period. Prior to the pursuit of performance, institutions carefully acquired or disposed of their holdings in order not to disrupt the market. Now some managers acquire or dispose of large blocks in a matter of hours. In fact, this is one of the phenomena that we have witnessed in many instances where positions that may have taken, that is, when I say positions, that is a buying a block of securities, that may take weeks to accumulate in the public market, and then suddenly a disposition may be made of that block of stock in a matter of hours or a week, with very disruptive consequences for the market. When the smaller investor or the broker for a smaller investor or a company executive sees the disruptive effect these actions have on the market for a stock, they are dismayed and often blame the scapegoats of an earlier day, such as the specialist, who also may be dismayed. All of these individuals, investor, broker, specialist, company executive, are involved with the money managers, since as much as 45% of market volume can come from this source. If the new game works, all seems well. But if there should be serious reverses, who would lose and who would be blamed? We all would lose, and we would all be to blame. For the last few years, there has been disquiet in the industry about the system for trading and processing securities. First, it was concern about the capacity of exchange markets to handle trading volume. Then we were beset by back office paperwork crush. Then problems of all involving the commission rate. The question of who should be a member of an exchange is now a current industry debate. These are serious topical issues. But is it a coincidence that has created all of them simultaneously, or is there a larger issue that transcends these matters? I cannot help but feel that somehow those of us involved in answering these questions may have lost our focus. We devote much of our effort to effects or symptoms when the time has come to examine underlying causes. Obviously, many changes in the securities industry and the markets are long overdue. And I think those of us on the industry who are concerned with the problems are conscientiously going about the task of responding to the need for change. But it will do little good to make what now seems to be significant changes unless we are confident that they will, as a total response to a fundamental shift of forces in the market, balance power with responsibility in the public interest. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you very much for an enlightening area that many of us know not very, very much about. I'm going to ask Lillian, who's the chairman of today, to take the questions. And I think there is one right here, Lillian, that you might
even start with. Do you have some? And you could send up any questions that you have now.
Esther, you better lower this from the other. Small, you know.
Oh, wait a minute.
Other way. It says, "Sir, if you could advise women investors who are middle-aged, widows in modest circumstances, what would you say?"
I can only give a quick answer to that question. That is, get good investment advice.
Where do you get that?
Yes, where do you get that?
Well, I think the serious answer to that question is obviously everyone has different circumstances and conditions, and they have their own particular investment needs. But I think there are in the market and in the financial community numerous people to whom you can turn for investment advice. And I think that's really the best answer to that question.
Do you think the small investor will be eventually excluded from the market, as many brokers are suggesting?
I don't think the brokers are suggesting that the small investor be excluded from the market. In fact, I think those of us in the financial community who understand how the markets operate and what has built these markets know that they're based upon the activity of the smaller investor. He's absolutely essential to the continued viability of the markets that we now have. So I don't think the enlightened members of the financial community in any way want to turn away the smaller investor, because the smaller investor is what makes the markets go. It's what's responsible, really, for the growth of this economy of ours.
What type of regulations can the exchanges suggest in order to avoid the types of disruptions you mentioned in your talk?
I don't really know the answer to that. I think the fundamental thrust of my remarks is that I'm raising a question, I think, a very important question that affects all of you in this audience that are investors, that affects the markets and the financial community. I think the task really is to get the facts, to find out what the problems are here, and then to determine whether any kind of regulatory action, if any, is necessary. But I think the first problem really, it seems to me, is to get the facts. I might say, and I didn't mention this in my remarks, that process is going on now through the institutional investor study, which is being conducted by the SEC and which is to report to Congress sometime later in this year.
Would you explain the role of the specialist on the floor of the exchange?
You know, it's interesting how the specialist has always been regarded as kind of the high priest in the market. Actually, his role is really relatively simple. Let me describe the situation in the ideal market. And the ideal market would be one where public buy and sell orders matched all of the time. In other words, where 100 shares of AT&T came in to be sold, and 100 shares came in at the very same time to be bought at the market. In that kind of situation, where you had matching of orders through time, there would be no need for the specialist. But what happens now if 500 shares come in to sell and there are only 100 shares to buy from the public? If you're going to have reasonably continuous markets without wide gyrations in price, it means that somebody's got to come in and provide continuity. And that's the function of the specialist. So in the situation I just described, in other words, 500 shares to sell at the market, 100 shares to buy, the specialist would step in. Of course, this depends upon a lot of other facts, but under ordinary circumstances would step in and buy some of that, the 400 shares, some or all of the 400 shares to sell. in order to provide a continuous market with minimum price disruptions. The problem comes about, though, that 500 shares of AT&T or whatever it may be is no longer 500 shares. In many cases now, it's 5,000, 50,000 shares, 500,000 shares. Well, then the question comes, who's going to step in to provide that continuity? And at times, I would say there isn't enough capital in all of Wall Street to provide that kind of continuity in the markets. And I think that's one of the fundamental problems that I was touching upon in my remarks.
Considering the down market, can you explain the steady rise of certain stocks?
Well, as they say, it takes many people to make a market. And obviously, there are stocks at all times that move against the trend, the basic trend of the market, because of different financial prospects, different investor evaluation of the particular security. So I think in general declining markets, you'll get stocks that will rise, and in generally rising markets, you'll get stocks that fall. I think it's just in the very nature of a market where you have differing investor evaluations of what's going on.
Mr. Saul, you stopped at a very interesting point. What changes do you advocate to meet the new developments?
That is a very good and interesting question. I don't have the answers. If I did, I suppose I could. I would be telling them to you or giving you my thoughts at this point in time. I really don't have the answers, but I do think it's essential that we start framing these issues and questions, and that we try to conscientiously go about finding the answers. I think that is the mission of the Institutional Investor Study, which the SEC is now conducting, and as I say, is due to report later in the year.
Just a few more. Sure, I'd be delighted.
A recent financial report has indicated there will be either a mild or severe recession. Can you comment on this recession and the consequent results of the mild and severe?
I think one thing I've learned as a stock exchange president, and that is you do not comment on the state of the market, nor do you give economic forecasts. So, ladies and gentlemen, if you don't mind, this is one I'm going to defer to.
What do you see as the future of the small investor, if any? Do we need new ways in which small investors can get the benefit of high interest rates?
Well, in a sense, this is a question that's unrelated to my business, since we pay dividends, not interest rates, on stocks, and I'm primarily in the stock market. I do feel that where there is a demand, and there is a demand by smaller investors for instruments, money instruments with higher interest rates, that somewhere along the line that demand will be met. The fact of the matter is, at least from my limited knowledge of this area, that many what we call money instruments have been devised primarily for the larger investor and institutional customers. But it seems to me with this situation that's developing, we may find some change in that, and some of these instruments may be made for the smaller investor.
Thank you, Mr. Saul.
Well, it's my pleasure.
Speaking of instruments, we'll have to get this one fixed, I'm quite sure. You know, some of the young folks today are wearing a button that says, if you're not part of the solution, you're part of the problem. And I think that we have someone who recognizes the problem is definitely part of the solution, and we thank him very, very much.